Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with two members of his senior leadership team, Chief Operating Officer Gina Lynch and Chief Financial Officer Joe Funks, about education savings accounts. As ESAs potentially expand from serving exclusively children with unique abilities to becoming ubiquitous in the world of public education, Tuthill, Lynch, and Founce explain the complexities of managing programs such as the Gardner Scholarship. How do you balance managing what's in the best interests of families while preventing fraud, cyber attacks, and adhering to statutes defined by law? And what role does artificial intelligence play in the expansion of ESAs? Those questions and more on this episode of Podcast Ed.
Today, I'm excited to have Gina Lynch, who's the Chief Operating Officer of Step Up for Students, and Joe Founce, who's the Chief Financial Officer of Step Up for Students, to talk a little bit about managing educational savings accounts. Through the pandemic, we've seen that ESAs have become increasingly popular with families. Families are interested in having more flexibility in terms of how they spend their money, making sure they keep their children safe, and also get a good education. And so you see a lot of dialogue about ESAs as a future of education choice. The challenge, of course, is managing ESAs is highly complex. It's a very difficult process to make sure that the programs are done with a lot of effectiveness and efficiency. So I wanted Joe and Gina, who are really experts in this area, to talk about what it takes to really manage an ESA in the most effective and efficient way possible, particularly when you go to scale. So Joe and Gina, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Yes.
So let's start. I want to sort of walk through from a student perspective. Gina, why don't we start with you? Talk about what has to happen to begin to onboard a student onto the ESA program.
Sure. So when a family finds out about our educational savings account programs, they typically go to our website, they begin the application process and submit the necessary documentation. In this case, it could be some medical documentation for special needs. And our staff at Step Up for Students is trained to review this documentation and make sure we have everything we need, that all the paperwork that we need in order to follow the guidelines set forth in statute. Once they apply and we have reviewed their application and determined them eligible, that begins the whole process of them becoming onboarding into the educational savings account system.
Don't you also have to do work with DOE and some of the cross-checking? Is that also part of the process?
Right. So as we are reviewing the application, as Doug mentioned, it gets a little more complex. So we are partners with the Department of Education, and we will make sure that once we've done a first round of approval on the student for eligibility, we will also send that student over to the Department of Education so they can do some what they call cross checks to make sure that the student is not in a public school. Because according to the rules, the families are not allowed to be in two or more things at once.
So the family navigates the application process, your team works with DOE to get them eligible. Then what happens next? They're now eligible to be part of the educational savings account program. What's the next step?
Right. So our system and our team of people alert the families that, hey, you've been awarded this scholarship. Here's the next steps. And we send them a series of things through our platform so that they know exactly what they need to do. We do have a call center and a contact center that they can call to get more information. But this is the point of when a family actually is, what do we do next? And there are some other steps that happen, which I'll like to have Joe Founce start to talk about, which begins more on the monetary and financial side of these educational savings accounts.
So when the DOE tells us that, okay, this parent is not in public school, as Gina referenced, and they're eligible now they're approved for the program. They send us a file and we bring that file back into our systems and we create an account in our system for that student. And then along with that comes an electronic payment from DOE for all of the students that were covered in that particular file. And so that our example student here, we would fund their account. And so now the student's account has whatever their scholarship amount was in there. If by chance they had been on a student that had been in a prior year, there would have been a balance in the account. And we would just add that to it. But in the case of a new student, it's the original amount that the scholarship was awarded to the student for, and the DOE provides us with those funds.
So using round numbers, suppose we have 20,000 students who are approved, which is about the number in our Gardner program, which is an ESA for kids with unique abilities and special needs. So 20,000 kids are approved, and then DOE would send a payment. It's quarterly, right? So they would send a quarterly payment for 20,000 kids, and you would take each of those payments, and that money would be distributed to each child's account. Now, are those accounts held by Step Up? Are they in a bank? Where are those accounts actually located?
Well, we actually put the totality of all the students' accounts into one bank account. Then we keep the subledger. We keep the individual student accounts on our system.
Okay, and you did mention too, I just want to make sure our listeners know this, that one of the features of ESAs is if you don't spend all the money 1 year, it rolls over. So you could have a renewal student who, let's say, qualifies for $8,000, but might have $1,000 already in the account. So when you get the DOE payment, you would add that $8,000 to the $2,000 in the ledger.
Correct.
So now I'm a parent. I have, maybe $9,000 now in my account, and I want to spend money on a variety of things. Perhaps I'm interested in a tutoring program for my child because I know my child is struggling in math. I want to buy a couple courses from a local private school that my family is very comfortable with. I want to perhaps purchase some reading materials that I think would help my child in reading. And maybe my child has some physical challenges. Maybe there's occupational therapy that I'm trying to deal with. So walk through for me, Joe, how a family would, what are the various ways in which they can spend the money in order to access these kinds of services. And also I'm curious about how do you make sure that they don't spend the money inappropriately? Suppose that I want to buy something that falls outside of state law. How do you guys manage that process?
Well, there's three ways really that they can spend their money. They can go out and use their own funds and purchase something and then submit a reimbursement to us. Then we have the ability to have vendors sort of pre-registered on our system. The vendor, then they can go out to that vendor and receive those services, submit an invoice to us, and then upon approval, we can pay that. Or they can use our sort of online marketplace called My Scholarshop, where we have pre-approved goods like curriculum and things of that nature on our My Scholarshop platform, and they can go out and they can buy directly from there. So the direct pay to vendor really eliminates the need for the parent to come out of pocket for those funds, as does My Scholarshop. My Scholarshop currently only has products on there. So, if they needed a tutor or a therapist, they would have to do the direct pay or do the out of pocket.
My Scholarshop is in essence a kind of an e-commerce site for products. All those products are pre-approved, right? So if I go into the My Scholarshop and I look in the catalog, everything's pre-approved. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's all pre-approved. We go to these vendors and we negotiate contracts with them. We negotiate prices, and then we take, most of them have very broad catalogs. We'll take certain products out of those catalogs that we know are approved. They've been approved in our manual process. We've vetted them and we know they're approved, and then we put them on My Scholarshop so that parents can only see products that are already approved and do serve an educational purpose.
If I want to buy some educational software, then I go on My Scholarshop. I find that software that's pre-approved. I purchase it, but I don't have to pay out of pocket. Step Up would pay directly. Is that correct?
Right. The parent does the basically they hit buy, and then it it sends the purchase order to the vendor and says, hey, you ship this product to this parent. The vendor sends us the invoice. This is all through an automated system, and then we pay that invoice. And you know, the parent gets their shipment, and the transaction's completed.
I think for our listeners, it's important to know, as they hear about all these ways that parents can spend this money, the evolution of it. So when Gardner was passed 5-6 years ago, it was a reimbursement only. So parents had to pay out of pocket for every little thing that they wanted to buy. And part of my job is to listen to customer feedback. And we were hearing that I can't afford to always pay out of pocket for some of these things. So over the years, we've developed relationships with, what Joe said, vendors, so that we could work with vendors directly for payment and keep the parent from paying out of pocket. My scholar shop does that as well. So that's why we developed that platform. So, you know, we're constantly introducing new ways to help our families to be able to spend their money, but not have to put a burden on them. So I think it's helpful to understand why we have all these different ways of that we've produced to let families to interact with their ESA account.
So one of your goals is to try to minimize out of pocket.
Yes.
So you try to find vendors that are most popular with families, negotiate deals with them for the purchase price. That includes shipping and tax. Is mm-hmm. that correct, Joe?
Yeah. Yes, it does.
And then, so that tries to minimize the out-of-pocket expense, because not a lot of families can afford, you know, to pay out-of-pocket and wait for reimbursement. Mm-hmm. But there's always going to be some reimbursements, right? So if I'm at a local bookstore and I see Treasure Island and I want to buy that for my child, you know, that, and I just on the spur of the moment put out $15 for Treasure Island, then I would just get a receipt and submit that. Is that how it would work on that side?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. So we forgot to mention this, but how do you know what's acceptable and what's not acceptable to purchase? I mean, what are the guidelines? Where do those come from?
You know, that's part of the, I would say, one of the most challenging aspects of managing an ESA is we are, as a scholarship funding organization, we're given the statute and the guidance on categories that they can spend their monies on. And they're very, some of them are very broad. Some are very cut and dry, like you can spend it on tuition and fees. That makes sense. That's easy. Other categories, such as instructional materials, can be anything from a computer to a pencil to a stuffed animal to a TV. And so that's where all the complexities comes in. And our staff and spends most of their time working through items that families want to purchase. So what we do is when families purchase things, we have a whole staff that looks at these reimbursements as they come in. And we really do take care to bump them up against the law and the policies to make sure we can fit those expenditures into a category. In the event we're audited, we want to protect the integrity of the program. Other states have had issues with this, and we really want to protect that, because the program is very important to us and our families. We've also done things to help this process where families can submit pre-authorizations. So if a family decides they really need to purchase item X, but they're not sure it'll be covered under the program, we ask them to submit documentation to us, letting us know, what is this for? What are they planning on buying and the cost of it? And they'll know beforehand, before expending the money, where that they can buy that item or not. And this way it makes sure that the family is not out of pocket for money and they didn't realize that they shouldn't have bought that item.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, as Gina pointed out, we're really just finding the right balance between flexibility and accountability. You know, we also really, through parent feedback, we get a lot of, you know, we sort of re-challenge ourselves when we make a decision, and then we get parent feedback, and then we go back and say, okay, do we need to reconsider this? So it's really a constant process of determining, you know, if it's something that should be covered under the statute. I mean, we also, you know, just from an accounting and finance perspective, we look at it, you know, we make sure that the invoice is a valid invoice. We make sure that it, you know, it adds up. before we pay the bill. We do all those sort of things that you would typically do before you paid something. We make sure that it is properly supported, you know, not outside of the statutory educational purpose side, but just from the invoice itself, to make sure that it's a proper invoice and that it adds up to the amount that we're paying. We also, you have to check against their balance at all times. So when the parent goes to make a purchase, they're able to check their balance. My Scholar Shop that we mentioned earlier will check their balance. The system won't let us pay more than they have in their account. So that checking is always going on as well.
Is it fair to say that probably most of the contention in the program is parents really fighting to expand the categories, you know, because everybody's advocating for their children and your staff is trying to be as flexible as possible to support the families, but at the same time, trying to implement the law with as much fidelity as possible. When you have a lot of gray area, that's kind of where the rubs are. Is that fair?
Well, absolutely. One of the things I wanted to mention that not a lot of our listeners or families or even lawmakers or anybody knows is we have learning specialists on staff looking at, does this work for the program? Does it work for the student? We have a parent advisory council we go to for advice. We have a school advisory council. We have people on staff from compliance, and we work tirelessly to give as much levity as we can. And we keep saying this, but I'll repeat it again, we need to protect the program. And being in the customer service side, I get a lot of the feedback from families that we're being too strict on one side, or we're being too lenient on another side. And so we're always in that balance of trying to figure out how do we let families do what they need to do, but with making sure we're not violating any laws. And it gets to be a big challenge in some cases.
Yeah, and I would add to that, an additional challenge is being consistent across mm-hmm. All of our people that are looking at these reimbursements that come in, because if we're not training them very well, then you're going to have one interpreting what we've said to do one way and one interpreting it another way. So there's always that challenge as well, is just to keep consistency across our reimbursement staff.
And what we find from the families, just one last thing on this, is our families, when you're home educating a child, almost anything can be used for education. So cooking equipment has been a hot button for us over the years, measurements and things. And that makes total sense. But there are some things that don't fit in that. So, anything can be justified. But it comes down to the fact of, is this really what this item is? Is it intended to do does it have a true educational purpose? And at the end of the day, we have to ask ourselves that.
It's also a challenge. Joe mentioned consistency, but children aren't necessarily all the same. And so mm-hmm. you could have a child, for example, who might have a hearing challenge, and the parent might submit a receipt for a $120 set of earphones. And you guys might approve it because you have documentation showing that the child is severely challenged from a hearing perspective and needs that. Another parent hears about it and submits $125 speakers or earphones, and you guys turn it down because that child doesn't have a hearing deficiency. And so parents talk to each other, but they don't always necessarily know the nuances of each child's needs, and you guys have to navigate all that. So I presume that's also a challenge.
Absolutely, it's a challenge.
So I want to talk about moving forward. Right now, Step Up is managing probably a little over 20,000 ESAs, counting the Gardner's program for kids with unique abilities, special needs, Down syndrome, spina bifida, autism. And there's a reading ESA for children in district schools that are struggling readers in grades 3 through 5. So probably together, those two programs, a little over 20,000. So you guys are managing more ESAs than anybody else in the country. I think the second largest state is Arizona with 9,000. But there's a lot of movement towards expanding ESAs in Florida. So we could potentially have up to 230,000 kids on ESAs in the fall of 2021. Talk to me about the terror that rings to you when you think about going from 20,000 to 230,000. What are the things that you guys are doing with your team to prepare for what quote could potentially be that many kids. And if it's only 4 or 5 reimbursements per family, which doesn't sound like a lot, but let's say it's 5 times 230,000 is well over $1 million. So talk to me about what you guys are doing to prepare for the future where ESAs become much more ubiquitous and you have hundreds of thousands of kids spending billions of dollars on educational savings accounts.
Well, you know, certainly, you know, technology is a key, and I'm sure Gina will talk a lot about what we're doing there. You know, we really just have to make our technology as automated as possible, really a frictionless transaction between the vendor and the parent, while at the same time we're getting that oversight for accountability. And meeting the statute, in addition to your typical financial controls over spending of money. So for us, it's really converting more and more of these processes to an automated technology based process, so that we can really let the technology do a lot of the work, and then we get more into an auditing role, where we're reviewing things on the back end, looking at exception reports and having other forensic tools that are helping us find these things as they come up, if there's something that is going on that shouldn't be going on.
Yeah, we are definitely, technology is the key word here in how we're gonna manage 200 plus thousand accounts. There's no other way. When we started managing ESAs 6 years ago, a lot of it was manual, and we had a system that was very rudimentary. And just like anything in technology, everything changes every year. Your television set has evolved, your phone has evolved. Well, we've gone through several iterations of platforms that we call them to help manage. And we're at a point now where we've got to get to the iPhone 12, or if you're an Android user, your Android latest version. So we're working on something we call Platform 2.0. And like Joe was saying, it's a platform. Think of e-commerce. Think of being able to purchase tuition and fees on there. You're being able to buy some tutoring sessions, being able to purchase a laptop, curriculum, anything on this anything that you can purchase under the guidelines of the statute for these programs will be on there for you. It'll be interactive. It'll be able to tell you what your balances are. And, long term, it'll be able to hopefully suggest things that other parents have purchased and have worked well, much like Amazon or Yelp or situation like that. So we have some big, lofty goals in order to be able to handle this, but it's really the only way we're going to be able to do it.
One of the very first things that we've begun to work on was we talked about student accounts. Well, right now those student accounts are embedded in our general accounting system. And to scale, as Doug talked about, to the levels that we're looking at, we're building basically an account system for our student accounts that'll just be much more flexible. It'll be able to interface with these different systems that we're building for various business commerce that's going on, whether that's through with a third party vendor or a tutor or whatever, and it'll just be faster and really be more secure as well when we get it finished. So there's just a lot of those kind of things that we're working on.
So in many ways, it's an e-commerce platform you guys keep working on, and sort of similar like Amazon, but it's way more complex than Amazon, because Amazon doesn't necessarily have to screen every purchase to make sure it's appropriate. So I guess that would be more like an Uber or an Airbnb. But of course, Uber and Airbnb have a very limited product offering or service offering. You guys are dealing with potentially hundreds of thousands of products and services, and you have to vet all those to make sure they're appropriate. So it's sort of a combination of Airbnb, Uber, and Amazon, all integrated into a single platform developed by a small nonprofit in Florida. Sounds crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, I argue that we're really in multiple business markets. We have to deal with schools. So there's tuition management systems out there. And how do we interface in that area. There's products, and we already have, you know, we're already in that area with our My Scholarship. But then you have, as Gina pointed out, the services side, tutors, and then therapists are in the medical world. And so each one of these have different ways of making payments and sending out invoices. And so we have to figure all that out. Unlike, as Doug pointed out, Amazon is really just selling products, and Uber is really just selling transportation services.
Yeah, we haven't talked too much about providers, but you guys all have to screen providers, right? So if I show up and say I'm a tutor, you don't necessarily approve me as a tutor. I have to follow the state law. So you also have to vet. Talk a little bit about that, vetting the providers. Gina, yep. You want to?
Yeah, I think that we're going to touch on that earlier. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there, as if you have children, you know, your next door neighbor comes over and tutors your child in math and your cousin or whatever. But in this program, there are stipulations that a tutor has to have certain credentials and to be deemed a tutor. So we have to check for all that before we can approve any type of tutoring reimbursement or any tutor that comes onto our provider platform. Same with therapists that we engage with for the Gardner Scholarship. They have to have certain licenses. They have to be licensed in the state of Florida. So before we're able to spend or reimburse $1 to that therapist, we have to go through a process of vetting them to ensure they meet all the standards that they're supposed to meet. So we have a whole staff that works on that as well.
You guys talked about sort of a technology as a key allowing you to scale up. And Gina, you mentioned things like helping families make better choices. Talk a little about how you're thinking about artificial intelligence. I know we have a contract with a company that is one of the top AI companies in the country. Talk a little bit about how you guys might see artificial intelligence helping us in the process moving forward.
So AI, artificial intelligence, is a scary term for some people, but it's being used in a lot of things that you don't even know. And we're going to need it for what we're trying to do. A lot of the questions we get is, you know, how are you preventing fraud or theft, which is one thing, but how are you ensuring that the parents are really, the families are really spending their money on things that are going to make a difference for that child? I mean, it's okay to buy a TV for somebody, but you know, what's your plan? So there's a lot of ways we can integrate into artificial intelligence to help us with that aspect of the program and making recommendations for families. And it'll be, you know, awesome for that, but it will also be helpful in what I just said, theft or inappropriate purchases, and using algorithms to help us figure that out before it's too late is where, just a couple ways. Joe, do you have any other examples that AI could be used that we're thinking about?
I think that's the main one. Just really a filter that sits over, you know, when a parent is searching for products or services, that filter would only bring back things that are really approved purchases. They couldn't even look at something, you know, in that environment that is not approved. And so it would really speed up the process, but it would also improve the ability to misappropriate. I think there's also ways in using the data that we have to start really looking at what are parents doing, you know, what are similar parents with, you know, similar children are doing, what's working for them, and using AI to really start creating profiles and say, hey, this might work for you. So it brings back products and services that say, hey, you live in this area, you know, this particular therapist has a 5-star rating with parents with similar circumstances. So I think AI can play a role there.
You know, Joe, a lot of credit card companies, I think all of them use AI to look at spending patterns. I think all of us occasionally get a phone call from our credit card company saying, hey, did you just really buy this gallon of gas in Juneau, Alaska? Seems like that may not be where you are today. Do you see something like happening? So maybe AI sitting over the purchasing and sort of looking for patterns if they see something strange, maybe kicking it up to a human person to look at to make sure that the purchase is appropriate. You think those kind of tools that might be appropriate also?
Absolutely. We talked about it a little bit earlier, and that would be sort of the next generation. We talked about exception reports and other tools within our systems, but if you had AI, it could really start looking for even activity maybe that's coming from the same IP address or maybe the same purchase being done on multiple accounts, but it's the exact same amount to the same vendor. It could look for little hints that maybe something's going on and raise that to somebody's attention on a dashboard. So, hey, you might want to look at this.
I know security is a huge priority for StepUp, and both your teams are obsessed with security. I know we spend millions of dollars on security. Talk a little bit about, we talked some of it already, but talk a little bit about how we try to make sure that we protect from cybersecurity, protect the safety of the data and the money. It's scary right now. I mean, you've seen break-ins at NSA, FBI, CIA, Justice Department, Commerce Department, you name it. I mean, the federal government seems to be getting hacked on a regular basis. There's a lot of really powerful tools out there to hack. So talk a little bit about the kind of things you guys do to try to protect against our systems getting hacked.
All right, I'll start with that a little bit. We focus an enormous amount of time and energy and money because we have very sensitive data, like most companies do. We have medical data, we have PII data, privacy data, and any of that getting out would be a disaster. So we employ a team of people at Step Up for Students who focus solely on cybersecurity. So we have organizations that also help in that space for us as well. That their sole focus is to make sure we're protected from ransomware attacks and viruses coming through and clicking on the wrong emails. We have computer software running constantly on our local laptops, all the way to our servers, all the way up in the cloud, just to kind of protect us from all those malicious attempts that are happening out there every minute of the day. So anything like that. We also go through extensive employee cybersecurity training as well, so that we don't inadvertently click on something that could cause a problem. So we put a lot of effort into protection against breaches of data or any security.
And from a banking and financial perspective, first of all, we have really all the services that the major banks offer with regard to account protection. For instance, an electronic payment could not hit our account without us approving that first. So we would have to go in and say, this vendor can take this money out of my account. So otherwise the bank's going to reject it. So no one can just go take money out. We have, if it's checks, we have blocks on our account where only the checks that we write can be paid out of our account. There's been a lot of attempts in that regard, and every business has it. And we've been able to prevent every one of those. And then we don't allow payments to hit directly on the accounts. So they have to go internally. They have to be reviewed, and then we say yes, we're going to make these payments. We're not allowing payments to occur that just come straight out of the account. We use electronic payments as opposed to like a debit card or anything like that, so that we can have that extra level of security.
Yeah, Joe, I remember you a couple of years ago, you were working closely with the FBI.
Yes.
Because people were trying to use our checks and forge them, and you did a lot of work with the FBI to try to make sure that didn't happen. And I also know that we in the past have turned off all the IP, incoming IP traffic from all of Eastern Europe. because we've had so many attacks from Eastern Europe that we basically shut down all those IP addresses. So I know that there's a room in Jacksonville. It looks like a NASA Space Center where you guys have people with all the monitors looking at all the various attacks that happen from all over the world, and all the systems are in place to block it. So probably in the conversation, in this 35 minute conversation we just had, I'm sure there's probably been 30, 40, 50 attempts to hack to the systems. And I know the systems are set up to try to protect that. So I think it's important for people to know that. You guys have been very generous with your time. Are there any other things that people need to know about the complexities and challenges of managing ESAs at scale? I know most people don't really appreciate all that goes into this, but both your teams do amazing jobs and will be doing in the future as we scale up. So is there anything else you guys think would be important to share with our listeners?
I think that I'd just like to say, you know, to our listeners who either use the program or recipients of the program or just watching, is there's a lot of complexity behind the scenes, but our main goal is to make it easy for parents. We're not here to roadblock them. And a lot of families do get upset with us if we can't approve certain items for purchase and things like that. But our intent is really pure for the parent to get what they need, but we also have a duty to protect the program as well.